Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back our great guest co-host today, Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Thank you very much, Adam.
And on our show today, we're talking with Dr. Jess Shatkin, professor of child and adolescent psychiatry and pediatrics at New York University, about his new book, Born to be Wild, Why Teens Take Risks and How We Can Help Keep Them Safe. It seems like both ends of those spectrum are essential.
Exactly. Looking forward to a great conversation with him.
First, we're going to talk about some research that matters, and let's dive right into our very first one about vitamin D.
It is interesting to see, as it's, you know, been in the news and so much in our training, and it's something that comes up every day in clinical practice. Somebody's asking me about, should I be supplementing with this? How much is enough? And every time that vitamin D is in the news, it always catches my eye.
Well, and this particular research is really interesting. You know, we measure vitamin D, and so many people are deficient, and we think, oh, the normal level somewhere around 20, 25, we can get people up to that. We think, oh, that's pretty good. And this research maybe challenges some of those assumptions, which is about vitamin D and mortality, not just vitamin D and bone strength or muscle aches, but mortality. What are we talking about here?
So this is looking specifically at people with cardiovascular disease, which is a significant amount of people in the United States. This study is actually coming from Norway. They found that people who had what were considered normal levels of vitamin D had a reduced risk of mortality by about 30% compared to people who had low vitamin D.
Yeah, and even high, but we don't see that too often here. And they followed 4,000 patients with heart disease for a period of 12 years. Most of these patients were over the age of 60. And they basically said if you had a value between 42 and 100, then you did better than if you had these lower values or higher values. And I found that really striking. You know, having a normal level of vitamin D may actually, particularly if you have cardiovascular disease, be life-saving.
It's amazing because we talk about high-tech solutions. And here's a relatively low-tech, basic idea that really has some big implications.
And, you know, I don't think this says anything about vitamin D in people who don't have heart disease. It doesn't say anything about vitamin D in people who have maybe levels at the lower end of a spectrum. But what it does say is if you were potentially thinking about taking vitamin D because your vitamin D level was low, and if you have a family history of heart disease or you have heart disease, probably stand up and take notice.
Exactly. I think that in terms of the potential gains from this and the potential downsides, it seems like the benefits that you can gain from the vitamin D are pretty overwhelming here.
But you don't want to get your levels up too high, because that's what they also found. And so the average dietary amount, you know, as a younger child, maybe 400 units a day is the kind of the recommended through dietary and other mechanisms. As you get older, it gets up to 800 units a day. If you're deficient, you might need to take 1,000, 2,000, sometimes even higher to get that. And then there's probably some monitoring should be done. So I think, like most things, common sense, but also monitoring. Let's talk about our very next research that matters. This is something that I didn't know a whole lot about, but I'm also now really interested in. It's about essential oils and health, and particularly about male health and what they call gynecomastia, or enlargement of the young male breast. What's going on here?
So this is something, the essential oils themselves, that are things that I'm not necessarily as familiar with myself, but the two that they studied, lavender and tea tree oil, are two that I am familiar with. I love the tea tree shampoos, and we use lavender around the house to try to keep spiders away. I don't know if that actually has scientific evidence, but this study was actually a study that came from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences here in North Carolina, and it showed that among certain young boys, just a small subset in the study, the use of lavender and tea tree essential oils actually led to the development of breast tissue or gynecomastia.
Yeah, they had looked at, I think, 8 chemicals from the hundreds that go into these oils, and 4 of them appeared in both the tea tree oil and the lavender oil, and they tested them on human cells. And 8 of these demonstrated some degree of promoting estrogen or inhibiting testosterone. So we do know that promotion of estrogen stimulation can actually produce gynecomastia in the male. So what do we do with this research?
That's a great question. I was going to ask you that same thing.
I got you first.
I think that overall it's hard to know what to make of it. As the authors themselves say here, these effects are unexpected. They weren't expecting to find this at all. And it's really hard to comment right now without further data. This is something from a research perspective that there's clearly more research necessary. But right now, I think that it's the refrain we say oftentimes as family doctors, everything in moderation. Sometimes it's better to have a little bit of caution than to jump into things that we might not know all of the effects of.
Yeah, I agree. And also, we also say in medicine, do no harm. So if there is a potential for harm, I think we should be cautious. I think if you had unexplained or gynecomastia, this would be in the thing you might look at. And also, I personally, it raises a question for me about, you know, women who shouldn't have estrogen exposure of breast cancer. It raises some profound issues. I don't think we have the answers, but I think we're raising the questions.
I think that the coming years are going to have a lot of increased data on who is most susceptible to this and who should we really be giving guidance to avoid these products.
Talking about guidance, we get asked about insomnia, inability to sleep, I think, every day. And this question of sleeping issues and genetics, though, is one that I found really fascinating and new. Have you been taught very much in your training about the genetics of sleep?
No, I think as a general approach, I always assume that there's some genetic component to most things. But the genetic component to sleep is something that's new, especially because we tend to emphasize the behavioral components of sleep so much, of good sleep hygiene, and tend to downplay any sort of a genetic part of it.
And I would agree with that, and that's my training as well. But I tell you, I'm getting really interested in more and more so in understanding this interplay between genetics and behavior. And this is research that was in the journal Molecular Psychiatry, and they were looking at DNA from 33,000 soldiers of different ancestry to understand how perhaps where the insomnia gene is located, and seems to be on chromosome 7, maybe also on chromosome 9, but then also linked to other things like obesity, diabetes, alcohol. So it made me all of a sudden start realizing that these things could be linked. Things that we think aren't linked could be linked. And someone who's at risk for insomnia may be at risk for obesity and diabetes. We would want to know. We'd want to be able to intervene. We'd want to be able to target our therapies, which right now we kind of lob a whole host of things in there and hope some of them stick.
There are all sorts of conditions that we've known are associated, and exactly how they're associated, it's not quite clear at this point. I think as the genetic analysis gets better and we're able to map all of these chronic conditions together with things like sleep problems and figure out how do they all relate, we're going to be able to fine tailor our recommendations to people in ways that are going to give meaningful improvements for quality of life, because if we can help everybody sleep a little bit better at night, I think that's one of the best things that we can do for everybody's day-to-day well-being.
I believe in that. The last research that matters is about I talk versus me talk versus you talk versus we talk.
Sounds like a bad pop song.
Well, you certainly don't want me singing this, but this was actually in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. And in a 2015, when they did this research from the University of Arizona, normally we would use the term I daily, maybe 1,400 times. But there's a subset who use the word I, me, my up to 2,000 times a day. And is that an issue at all?
They make the point also that typically we associate I talk with narcissism. And they mention not so, that I talk was associated more with tendencies toward anxiety and depression.
Still not good.
Still not good.
Right. So this negative emotionality they talk about, and this was 4,700 people from six labs in two countries, United States and Germany. And I think this is really interesting because it suggests things that we could be aware of as family doctors, as parents in our children that may say, we might have something here that we want to bring up with providers, ways of understanding how we can better take care of folks. The ironic thing, of course, is in some conditions like addiction and adults, it is important to say I because you have to take responsibility for it. The question would be, at other ages, that may be a marker for some things that aren't good.
This really underscores that when somebody comes to us, comes to a family member, a friend saying, I, thinking about, is this a sign of some emotional distress underneath? As the authors mention, thinking back to the last time that any of us had distress and that woe is me moment, thinking about the statements that we were saying and how much we were probably using I at that time as well.
That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. And we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Jess Schatkin, professor of child and adolescent psychiatry and pediatrics at New York University, about his new book, Born to be Wild, Why Teens Take Risks and How We Can Help Keep Them Safe. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jonathan Fricke. We'll be right back. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Today on Conversations, Jonathan, we're talking with Dr. Jess Schatkin, professor of child and adolescent psychiatry and pediatrics at New York University, about his new book, Born to be Wild, Why Teens Take Risks and How We Can Help Keep Them Safe.
Welcome, Dr. Schatkin.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be with you.
You know, it's great to have you on the show, and as a father of three teens, I'm hoping you're going to have the answers for me today.
I have lots to say for sure. I hope you find them to be useful.
I think it will. But, you know, before we just dive right in, and there's so much to discuss here, I think we'd like to know just a little bit about you. How did you become interested in medicine and child and adolescent mental health?
Sure. I actually went to medical school a little bit late. I was 29 when I started. I went to college at Berkeley and started the pre-med courses and found the courses difficult and not very fun, and I found the pre-med students even more difficult and less fun. So I decided that I wanted to work in public health, and I finished the pre-med courses, and I majored in history, and I started working in public health, and I graduated college in 85, and that was when HIV/AIDS was really hitting ground. We had a new name for it, and we understood it a little bit better, and I knew people who were affected by it growing up in the Bay Area who were sick. And so I thought I should go spend some time in public health, and I spent the next 7 years working in public health. And in fact, I even got my MPH, my master's in public health, in your neck of the woods at Chapel Hill at UNC from 86 to 88. And I went to Los Angeles, subsequently worked in occupational safety and health. And during that time, decided to go to medical school. Now, why kids? I had spent 5 summers as a camp counselor. My father was a pediatrician when I was young. He actually became a psychiatrist and child adolescent psychiatrist. And I just found that mental health was an area where there was so much misinformation, such a need for advocacy, such a need for public health work, actually, that I thought I could do the best good and probably have the most fun and do what was most natural for me by working with kids and families and trying to help them understand the struggles they have and to be successful in their future. You know, most mental illness sets on in childhood, and by adolescence, literally by adolescence, about 50% of kids have at some point met criteria for a psychiatric disorder. As a result, there's an awful lot that we can do and an awful lot that gets derailed during that time. And if we can prevent, if we can get in there early, then I think we can make a huge difference in people's lives.
We're so glad you did.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about the calling from going from individual clinical care to writing this book, Born to be Wild?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, coming from a public health perspective, as I explained, the constant sort of jockeying back and forth between working on the individual levels you describe, a doctor in an office, maybe teaching medical students and residents and seeing patients directly, to actually getting out in public and doing more, whether it's radio like with you guys or whether it's writing a book and giving talks or building programs. And so I've tried to straddle those two domains successfully throughout my career. I've always kept my eye on both. And books are one way to do that. This is the second book I've written. I edited a third book, so I've been thinking about books for a long time. This is the first time I've written a book for a general audience, though. So this was exciting to do because actually much harder than writing a professional book because it's filled with story and trying to, you know, explain the science and the details and the interventions I want to get across, but in a way that anyone would want to read as opposed to only a physician.
So talking about speaking to general audiences, can you give our listeners just a general idea, 101, what's going on in a teen's brain? What's the difference between a teen's brain and an adult's brain?
Yeah, sure. So I think there's a nice trajectory to think about. When you're young, prior to puberty, your brain is growing rapidly. And this gray matter or these nerve cells of the brain are growing, because the brain doesn't know what it's going to be yet. You don't know if you're going to grow up to be a gardener or a mathematician or a baseball player. And so your brain is open. And around puberty, your brain starts to prune, just like you would prune a rose bush. And you start to pull back some of that gray matter, about 1% per year throughout the teen years and into your 20s. So you're losing some of your gray matter or your potential. And this is why people who learn a foreign language at 18 or 25 or 30 don't tend to sound like natives. But if you learn it at 5 or 10, you do tend to sound like a native because your brain is really much more adaptable, or as we say, plastic when you're younger. As you hit teen years, you start to replace that gray matter, that 1% loss per year that's pruned away, with white matter. And white matter makes the transmission between parts of the brain much more efficient, much faster. It recharges quicker, and you actually move things around about 3,000 times faster than you do when you're younger. So you have much more communication in the brain by the time you're 25, 26, 27, when this process is complete, and less flexibility, and life goes on that way. So that's the big picture, the 10,000-foot view. And then on a smaller level, or on a more micro level, what this means is that adolescents are coming of age and dealing with new challenges and stresses at the same time as their brain is absolutely changing. And a big part of the book that I wrote is really about explaining this process and explaining what goes on, whether it's dopamine, whether it's reward system, whether it's threat, the amygdala, whether it's the sexual drives and desires or the desire to be with peers or the evolutionary mandate that our brains sort of push us through, trying to understand all of that and on the one hand have some empathy for these teens because they make a lot of silly mistakes, but they don't usually mean to piss us off and to foil things for themselves.
You know, you have a saying that, you know, what were you really thinking? And you show in your book these things that even as a family doctor, I know, but it just, I want to go, oh, when I hear about the statistics that you discuss about how many teens text or email and how they drive under the influence of alcohol and exposure to sexually transmitted in teen pregnancy. What differentiates between those that do this, which is a large number, but yet the majority of teens don't do this?
Well, I think actually most of those statistics you're talking about are statistics over a 30-day period. So it happens that I think most teens actually do some of this stuff sometimes. I don't think they do it all the time. I think when they feel pushed, when they feel exhausted, when they feel over-caffeinated and underslept, when they feel overstressed by school, parents, extracurriculars, peers, then they start to make mistakes. And we do as adults as well, but they have much less experience and much less understanding or a real grappling with the outcomes that can happen or that can befall them. And as a result, they tend to do these things more often. You know, we could probably survey lots of physicians who would acknowledge if there was a truth test that they'd driven drunk before, maybe when they were teenager, or maybe they'd had two drinks and they knew they shouldn't have drank. It wasn't a ton, but they weren't at their best, you know. We know this happens. In fact, we know that people who stay awake for 24 hours, like doctors on call, when they get behind a wheel, they drive as if they were drunk. They drive as if they have a blood alcohol level of 0.08%, just like someone who's drunk legally. So we do this kind of thing all the time. It's a question of there are some who do it more, that's for sure. And part of the book is aimed at trying to figure out who those people are who do more and trying to understand how they might be different from others.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Jess Schatkin, professor of child and adolescent psychiatry and pediatrics at New York University, about his new book, Born to be Wild, Why Teens Take Risks and How We Can Help Keep Them Safe. We'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Golson and Dr. Jonathan Fricke. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Jonathan Fricke and Dr. Adam Goldstein. We've been talking with Dr. Jess Shaikin, Professor of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Pediatrics at New York University. We're talking about his new book, Born to be Wild, Why Teens Take Risks and How You Can Help Keep Them Safe. So earlier we've just been talking a little bit about the background and starting off with the book, and we're going to get the chance to dive a little bit more in depth now. One of the phrases that you used in the book is reward, not punishment. Can you help to unpack that a little bit?
Sure. So we know from lots of studies, whether we're looking at animals or whether we're looking at humans, children, even adults, that people respond much better to reward than they do to punishment. You know, when you think about getting an A on a test in school, if you get that A, you go home and you think, God, you know, I'm getting pretty good at this. It builds your self-efficacy. You feel better about yourself. And you probably go ahead and read a little bit more that night or get yourself ahead and ready. You don't let yourself fall behind in that class. But you get an F in that class. You think, ah, I'm no good. I'm terrible. I'll never do well in the subject or anything at all. And you kind of toss it away and tend not to study that night or the next day or after that. Reward is highly motivating, and it's motivating for a variety of reasons. You know, the brain has both threat and reward sensory sort of mechanisms in place so that we are driven to do those things that feel good so that they will promote our survival. And there's a lot in the book about evolution and how we are driven to eat certain foods or have sex or be engaged with peers because this gives us the potential for reward or good feelings. And those good feelings drive a lot of behavior. And kids are driven that way too from a very early age, even through adolescence. So when our kids are young, we might be cheerleaders like, hey, great job brushing your teeth. And as they get older, it might just be a pat on the shoulder when they do the right thing. But keeping close monitoring of our kids, which I address a lot in the book, knowing what their schedules are like, knowing what they're doing, and finding lots of opportunity to reward them. We get much, much further with reward than we do with punishment. I've known many kids who've had everything taken away from them. They just have a mattress in their bedroom. The parents say, we've taken away everything, nothing works. And there's a big problem with that. It doesn't work. You can take away things briefly, never for more than a day, nothing they've been looking forward to for weeks and weeks that is allowable for them to engage in. But always be on the lookout for reward. Catch them being good, we like to say.
Where were you when my kids were teenagers, Dr. Shaikin? I really needed you. I mean, no, it was so true that the punishment really didn't work with our children. But what worked was when they did something that, you know, was the sharing, was the kindness, was the opening up, that it really helped. And I guess one of the questions are, and we look at the epidemic of violence that I know it has to be something that's near and dear and oftentimes painful for physicians and providers who are taking care of these kids like you are. You talk about how many of our teens have mental health problems, but how little support there is in the school systems. I found that shocking.
Absolutely. It's remarkable. Fewer than 10% of U.S. 80,000 public schools have comprehensive mental health services. School is where our kids are. It's where they can get the treatment. And when we provide services in schools, kids actually get the care. When we don't, they very rarely make it into the community to get the care they need. And on top of that, most of the care that we offer in this country is not up to snuff. It is not following evidence-based practices and best practices. So we have a lot of room to go there. But the good news is we actually know how to treat so many psychiatric disorders now. We know how to treat virtually all the anxiety disorders, whether it's with psychotherapies, medicines, group interventions, or all of the above. We know how to treat depression very well. We know how to treat psychosis pretty well. We know how to treat, you know, dementia and drug abuse. The issue is having the resources for them. The consternating thing for physicians like myself, and probably for you fellows too, is that we hear in this debate, as we see and hear about school shootings and other, you know, violent acts, that we should provide more services for mentally ill because this is where this comes from. Well, we should always provide more services for the mentally ill because we don't have enough support for them. But most mentally ill people are not violent, and most violent actions, you know, are not driven by people who are in the throes of severe mental illness. Some of these acts take a lot of planning, and so what we need to do is really just be much more preventative in our efforts and then provide care where kids live, which is at the schools.
What can schools do on an everyday basis for the average teenager to help to prevent these issues from arising in the first place?
And that's a great question. That is a fantastic question. I could go on with this topic for hours, but let me try to keep it brief for you. We know enough about strengthening kids in the face of bad environments that we can help a lot of these kids. So preventatively, what we want to do is teach them things like emotion regulation, which is a major milestone of growing up in adolescence. How do you manage it when you feel angry, sad, in despair, even suicidal? What do you do? Because there are things that kids can do. And when they learn those tools, whether it's how to manage their mood or their anxiety, they do much, much better. How do you communicate with a parent who is difficult to work with, or a teacher or a coach or a friend? And there are actually real tools that we know that we can teach people that they can use to communicate more effectively and better and not feel so stranded. And how do you manage and just know about your brain and what peer effects do to you and what sleep does to you and drugs do to you? So part of this is education. Part of this is training. You know, I go to schools all the time. I'm in schools usually about a night a week. I give a talk at a PTA or a principal group or a teacher group. And I always start my talks every time by saying, what do you want for your kids by the time they finish this school, by the time they graduate? And usually I speak at high schools. And they'll say things like, I want my child to be a good sharer. I want them to do what they say they'll do, be responsible. I want them to follow through. I want them to care about other people. They never, ever say, I want him to be great at trigonometry, or I really want him to be able to interpret Shakespeare. Those things are important too, and they teach valuable skills. But one thing we don't do very consciously is teach people how to manage their emotion, build their self-efficacy, feel good about themselves. And there's good data that when we do that, kids feel better, they respond better, they get more rest, they are more responsible, they do the things that parents really want them to do, and we can teach some of that in schools. So that's first. And then secondly, we need to provide better mental health care in schools. As I said before, we really, for those kids who are slipping through the cracks or do have early signs, we need to intervene, because that can make a huge difference. And that can set somebody up and upright and help them to stay on their trajectory.
We've been talking with Dr. Jess Shatkin, professor of child and adolescent psychiatry and pediatrics at New York University, about his new book, Born to be Wild: Why Teens Take Risks and How We Can Help Keep Them Safe. And Dr. Shatkin, on behalf of your health listeners around the country, I must say I am so impressed by what you're doing and how important this book is. I have rarely, but I will say at this time, I want to encourage all of our listeners to go out and to get this book. I think it's important for society, it's important for public health, it's important for patients and families. I want to thank you for the time you put into doing this for the American public.
Oh, thank you so much. That makes me feel really good. I really appreciate it. And I worked hard. It's a message that I think is really important for all of us to pay attention to. I learned a ton by writing the book, and I think there's a lot of takeaways for parents, teachers, and clinicians in there. So thank you for your comments.
We're going to put a link up to this so our listeners can know how to access it. And we hope you'll maybe come back and share some insights as we hopefully learn from you.
I'm happy to speak with you anytime. Thanks for involving me, and thanks for inviting me on.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jonathan Fricke. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, Jonathan and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, you can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
Our first listener asks, recently I've been waking up several times during the night. It doesn't take me too long to fall back to sleep, but it is disruptive. Do you have any advice for me?
Well, that's a great question. And in light of our previous guest speaker, my first question is, do you have children? Because I can tell you, I don't know if I woke up as much before or after I had children. I think that I woke up a lot more, you know, after I had children. And part of it is maybe worry. Maybe you worry about things, and maybe that's a natural part of getting older. So I'd love to know kind of what's the family situation like here.
So you're saying wait 15 years and it'll get better?
Or maybe not natural. No, I'm not saying that at all. But I do think always understanding what is going on in someone's life is important here. Things that as family doctors, we really do want to know about.
I agree. Waking up multiple times during the night makes me wonder all about context. And it's what's going on in the family, but also what is the bedroom like? What is the temperature like in the room? How dark or light is it in there? Are there any noises? And also, are there any cell phones near the bedside? Are you checking Facebook or your text messages when you wake up in the middle of the night? And what are you doing to fall back asleep?
Yeah, you know, those are such important issues. And we also need to think about what are the medical things that are happening. So there are so many medications that can cause problems, can cause insomnia, as we talked about in our research that matters, that would cause you to get up at night to urinate, like a diuretic for a lot of people who take as a type of blood pressure medication.
And speaking of other medical conditions, if snoring is a big part of this as well, or difficulty breathing, talking to your doctor about sleep apnea is always a critical part of this evaluation.
Yeah, you know, we make assumptions, but frequently those assumptions aren't correct. One of them that sometimes we assume is that people would know that they're not supposed to drink before they go to bed, both alcohol or caffeine or even water. They're all diuretics, including just drinking the water. And I have sometimes patients say, yeah, you know, I drink and I don't drink enough during the day. So I drink, you know, 500 cc's or a half a liter before I go to bed. So I'm well hydrated. I'm like, well, aren't you going to get up? Yeah. And every time I get up, I have a glass of water. So I make sure that I continue to flush my system. I'm like, oh, we got a problem here. And then one of the most common things you probably see a lot, as I do, is for men in particular, is prostatic hypertrophy.
Exactly. And I think that a lot of times people just think it's a regular part of aging and something they got to deal with. And it's not necessarily. There are things that we can do to help out with that too, because getting quality sleep is an important thing as well.
Yeah, getting up four times a night, even if you have children, even if you're, is not normal. So bring this question to your family doctor, your primary care physician. Great question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm prone to biting the inside of my cheek. It's painful and it drives me crazy when I do it. Is there any reason that you think I might do this more than other people? And do you have any suggestions so I can stop doing it?
What do you think, Jonathan?
So I think the answer is that you're just prone to bad luck. And I think that some people who are chronic cheek biters tend to build up the inside of their cheek a little bit from that repeated trauma. And it makes it a little bit easier then. There's a sort of a ridge that develops, and that's easier to bite down on when you are chewing food or something else. Other times, I think it's a little bit more of just sheer luck.
Yeah, I do think there's an element here of kind of mind-body awareness that we have to kind of take care of, because you may have developed inadvertently a bit of a habit almost, particularly if you're doing things like gum chewing, which I've sometimes seen in people who bite their cheek and lips. And we have to break the habit. And so we have to actually maybe even do what we call CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, so that the cognition chewing doesn't result in the behavior biting. Ah, I've got to be able to chew without actually biting my cheek or my gums. That's not so straightforward. You might need some help.
And I think that when you talk about some attentiveness with this, mindless eating is probably a time when this happens most frequently for people. So taking time to be intentional about eating your food, savoring it, can go a long way into helping you to avoid chomping down on your cheek.
Yeah. Two other things that I think about. One would be massage. You know, we don't really think about the massage of the gums and the mouth and the what we call the TMJ, the temporomandibular joint, where the chewing comes from. But I don't know if you, Jonathan, or even Laura, you've ever had a massage and someone starts massaging the facial muscles and you go, oh, wow, I didn't realize I had tension all in my face.
How interesting.
Yeah, that's where you know it's a good massage, is when they find that tension you didn't even realize was there. A lot of us do hold tension in the TMJ joint or in other facial muscles. And so maybe when you're biting your cheek, this is a sign of more tension elsewhere.
Yeah, and then the kind of the corollary with that is relaxation. So some of the relaxation techniques we sometimes will teach patients are what we call progressive muscle relaxation, where you tighten a muscle real tight and then you relax it. And teaching people to do that up in their facial region, closing their eyes real tight and relaxing, squeezing the muscles of their mouth and relaxing them. So I'm thinking here that becoming more aware of that tension with some muscle relaxation would be an easy thing to probably practice, and I don't think there's a bad side effect from that.
I agree.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
My 15-year-old son is colorblind. He's about to start driving, and I'm a little nervous that it will affect his safety. Am I overreacting?
Coming from a doctor who's also red-green colorblind, probably my family would say absolutely not. Dad, the light is yellow. That's the one in the middle. But I'm not yellow colorblind. I'm just the red-green, the top and the bottom. But I do know what's top and what's bottom.
That's what I was wondering is, does that – I know the green is on one side, the red's on the other side, top and bottom – is that what you go by then to know when to stop and when to go?
It's interesting. And this is what I would ask our listener to find out with their son. They may be red-green colorblind, as I am, but they can probably tell the difference between red and green in a traffic light, which I can. Mm-hmm. So it may not be what we call full penetrance. I can, when I see grass, the grass kind of looks green. When I see blood, it kind of looks red. So, you know, I might have a difference between maroon and red, or light green and dark green, and maybe yellow green. I might get a little confused in that. But you know what? The traffic light, I don't think I have a problem. But what I would say is it wouldn't hurt to get one of these driving experts. Mm-hmm. You can sometimes have your 15-year-old, and this is a good thing for any 15-year-old, for not for the 15-year-old, but for the parent for certain, is you have them go out with a sheriff who now makes a little bit of money, and you pay them money, and they'll take your child around and do some defensive driving practice. But let them also see how they're reacting with the traffic lights. Because you know what? Their child's not going to respond to you, but that retired sheriff, that retired safety inspector, they'll respond. And the worst comes to worst, just let them drive with your spouse first. All right, what's our very last house call?
My doctor recently told me that he thinks I have IBS, which would account for the many digestive problems that seem to be caused by any number of foods that I eat. How should I reconsider my diet to respond to this diagnosis?
Well, this is a complicated question. My understanding is that there's no one explanation for irritable bowel syndrome, and the relationship between actual food is at most unproven.
The reality of it is that there are probably more irritable bowel syndromes, and that what is true for one person, like you said, is not true for another person. That being said, in general, there's more research coming out suggesting that the FODMAP diet, where you avoid, I'm not even going to be able to remember what FODMAP stands for off the top of my head, fermented oligo and monosaccharides and polyols, referring to specific types of sugar compounds that are in foods. And many of these foods are things that we think of as being healthy foods normally. A lot of these just have certain sugars that are more difficult for people to break down in their gut, and they can cause gas and bloating and diarrhea.
Yeah, and it gets us into the kind of the food antibodies, the inability to maybe absorb some carbohydrates, and then even the spectrum of people who have gluten insensitivity. But for the great majority of people, we don't really know if any of that really pans out. So this is one of the things that you're going to have to really work with your primary care provider. There are specialists who really do spend a lot of time doing research and treating irritable bowel syndrome. So if you need that extra layer of support, we would strongly encourage it.
This is something that doesn't get solved in a day, but through time of working with your primary care doctor, working with small changes in your diet to get the relief from the symptoms that you want.
Well, that'll conclude your health today, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. You can email us your own concerns at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter or Facebook. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank great guest co-host today, Dr. Jonathan Fricke, and our guest today, Dr. Jess Shack, and we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Jonathan Fricke.
and we look forward to talking to you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.